Good afternoon, everyone. So last time we began talking about hypersurfaces and how to do this 3 plus 1 or space and time decomposition of some four-dimensional manifold. Today I want to begin the lectures by talking a little bit more about this lapse and shift, and in particular give an example of how sort of all choices for these coordinates or time slicings or equivalently choices of lapse and shift are not all equal, in particular by giving an example of a quote-unquote bad choice of coordinates, which are Gaussian normal coordinates, and how that leads to coordinate singularities. So after that example, we'll spend the rest of the lecture basically doing this 3 plus 1 or space and time decomposition of the Einstein equations themselves. And if you want a reference for this part, you can see Carroll's textbook. In particular, it's in Appendix F. Okay, so last time we introduced these like lapse and shift, which determine basically how you divide your space-time manifold into slices of constant time. So perhaps the simplest gauge or coordinate choice for these would be what are called Gaussian normal coordinates. That's just where you choose the lapse to be 1, and you set the shift to be 0. And so equivalent in terms of metric functions, that means that the GTT component is just minus 1, and all the spatial GTI components are 0. Or in terms of this unit normal to our slices of constant time, which we called NA, that means it just has 1 for the time component, and all the spatial components are 0. So my claim is that this choice of coordinates actually corresponds to having this NA be the geodesics that just sit at some coordinate position for all time. So to check that these are in fact geodesics, let's write down the geodesic equation. So just using this expression, we can see that we can basically ignore all the spatial derivatives. We just get one Christoffel symbol, and then basically just using this fact, you can convince yourself that Christoffel symbol is 0. So these actually are geodesics. So we have a family of geodesics at each point. Okay, and we can also look at the I also claim that the trace of the extension of curvature in these coordinates is given by the following. So remember, K is the trace of the extension of curvature. And last class, we defined that basically by taking this covariant derivative of the unit normal and then applying this projection operator gamma. So again, because we're having a very simple form for our unit normal, we can simplify this. And you might recognize this as out to a minus sign. This is what's called, in the context of a set of geodesics, the expansion of a congruence of geodesics. Okay, so probably in your previous GR class, you saw the Rache-Rowdy's equation, which covers basically the deviation of a set of congruences of geodesics. I don't know, can you raise your hand if you've seen that before? Okay, maybe not all of you. But for those that haven't, maybe you can check this reference for more details, but basically you write down the deviation of a set of congruences of geodesics, and with a little bit of derivation, you arrive at the following equation. Right, so here these UAs are just some general set of geodesics. This theta is their expansion. Just the basically the divergence. The sigma AB is the shear. And omega AB is the rotation tensor. And here, of course, T is the proper time, or in general, some affine parameter along the geodesic. And of course, this is just our Ricci tensor. So, any questions about that? So, in general, this sigma AB is a spatial tensor, which means when you contract it with itself, it's greater than or equal to zero. And we're also going to make an assumption about the kind of matter we're looking at. So if we assume that we're satisfying the Einstein's equations, then we can just rewrite this using the trace reverse form. And the assumption that this quantity is greater than or equal to zero is what's known as the strong energy condition. And it basically just states that gravity is attractive in some sense. So as we'll kind of see what that means in a second. But you know, it's a sort of a reasonable condition for matter to satisfy. Okay, so now let's apply sort of these three things to Marx. So before I do that, so if we combine these two conditions with this equation, we can get an inequality. So basically that holds in general for some congruence of geodesics, as long as this strong energy condition is satisfied. And now let's apply it in particular to the set of geodesics that are given by these Gaussian normal coordinates. So we can, in place of theta, the expansion, we're just going to put in minus k, the trace fixed in the curvature. And we can also quickly calculate this rotation tensor. And again, you can convince yourself that that's zero. And so this inequality becomes this expression for how the trace of the extrinsic curvature evolves. So let's imagine we have some initial time slice where k is positive. So that corresponds to, in some sense, like a contraction of our space-time, or some gravitational attraction. And then let's integrate this inequality. So let's integrate from k0 to k. And then on this side, we'll integrate from tau equals zero to some later tau. And we get the following. Now what this means is that you know, initially, we're assuming that k0 is positive. But we can see it basically, if we wait enough time, you know, particularly if we wait until tau is greater than 3 times k0, 1 over k0, then this side will become negative, so k, 1 over k will have to become negative as well. But if 1 over k is going from positive to negative, that means 1 over k has to pass through 0, so k has to blow up. So that means our extrinsic curvature density is actually becoming singular, at least at some time. So what's going on physically here? So, I mean, you notice we haven't actually made any, like, there's nothing wrong with their space-time. It's not necessarily, there's no need to have any sort of physical curvature singularities or even some strong gravity. We basically just assume that we have at least a little bit of gravitational attraction. But our basically our choice of coordinates is not good, and so these sort of spatial tensors defined with respect to them are becoming singular because of that. So we can kind of think of what we're doing here is at t equals zero, you know, we're setting up these coordinates that are basically, you know, time is just the proper time for each of these quote-unquote observers that are moving along geodesics, and each one of these has a spatial coordinate associated with them that they just track as they move forward. But let's say we put, you know, a little bit of matter here or something. So as we continue these forward, you know, these freely falling geodesics will want to be attracted by the matter, say, and then at some point they can cross paths, right? So, you know, this is some coordinate here, this is a different coordinate here. But when they cross, which is called a caustic, basically we have some point that corresponds to some space-time point that has two different coordinate associated with it, so our coordinates are breaking down. And, you know, you can make this matter very weak. You just have to wait a long time for the caustics to eventually cross. So, you know, with a different choice of Lapson shift, you can avoid this breakdown. So any questions about that?
But it's only in the presence of matter, right? So without the matter,
I mean, not necessarily, right? We just, I mean, you can still have this equality even if this is zero, right? So you could have some gravitational wave or something that's, or a black hole or something that's causing the focusing. Okay, any other questions before we start talking about the Einstein equations? Okay, so the goal for the rest of the lecture is basically we're going to take the Einstein equations and rewrite them in this three plus one form, where we write everything in terms of spatial tensors and extrinsic curvatures and so on. And the expressions get a little bit long and tedious, but the sort of basic algebra is rather straightforward. So I'll try to write down the main expressions, but I won't go through every step. But if you're interested in all the details, again, those 3 plus 1 lecture notes that I mentioned before are a good resource. So before we actually get to the Einstein equations, we're going to begin by just doing a 3 plus 1 decomposition of the Riemann tensor. So we'll recall from last lecture that we can write the three-dimensional Riemann tensor the following way. The usual definition in terms of the spatial covariant derivatives. And then we can define these three-dimensional covariant derivatives in terms of projection operators of the four-dimensional ones. So, for example, for this one, lots of indices, but pretty simple. We just define this as the basically projection of the four-dimensional one. So if we take this expression for this and the equivalent for that, then we also use this relation between the three-dimensional metric or projection operator in the four-dimensional one and our unit normal. And also this expression for the derivative of the extrinsic curvature that I wrote down last time. So plug those things in. Go through a bit of algebra, then we get the following for this expression. So three-dimensional Riemann tensor, four-dimensional one. So now if we contract this C index with the A index, then we can get the three-dimensional Ricci tensor. All right, and we'll call this equation diamond, because we'll need that later. And then if we basically contract these two with this guy, our spatial metric, we can then get the three-dimensional Ricci scalar. We'll call this one star. We'll use that one later too. All right. So we can. All right. So now if we. Apply the. If we take the now four dimensional Riemann tensor and contract it with our unit normal n, and of course that can just be written in terms of covariant derivatives. And if we again apply these expressions and crunch the algebra, you get the following. And again, if we contract the C and the A together, we get the following to get things in terms of the Ricci tensor. Okay, and we'll call this equation smiley face to remind ourselves we're having fun. All right, so these expressions here actually go by the name of the Gauss-Kodachi relations. If you ever come across that term. So we're trying to work out the decomposition of the Riemann tensor. So far, we basically written down the ones where we take four spatial operators and apply it to the Riemann tensor. Then we've done the one where we have three of those and one of this one with the normal slices of constant time. So we've done those two. So now, of course, we'll do one with two spatial operators and two contractions of the unit normal. And then after that, we'll be done because basically if we take three of these and contract it with the Riemann tensor, then we just get zero due to the partial anti-symmetry of the Riemann tensor. So for this last one, get the following. All right, so then again, if we plug in an expression for the covariate derivative of n, we can put that in a slightly different way. In terms of the extrinsic curvature, and then here I'm going to write it in terms of a derivative of the lapse. So the last time I just called this the acceleration, but it could be written in terms of the lapse this way. So again, if we crank through some algebra on the right-hand side, we can use this. Get the following. And then finally, if we rewrite this in terms of the Lie derivative of the evolution operator, so. I'm going to plug in this relation. To rewrite that term, we get our last expression. All right, and we'll call this one triangle. All right, so we still haven't done any physics yet. We've just taken the Riemann tensor and basically projected it using n and gamma. So any questions about that so far? Did I make any index errors or anything?
That log term comes from?
Yeah, I mean, you can just like rewrite it as maybe like derivative of this is like the same as like this over this, right? So this was like the acceleration term basically, right? Because you had this extra term. So it's basically like, come from taking some derivative of the unit normal. And does everyone remember this evolution operator? This is just the lapse times this unit normal. So let's write down the Einstein equations. Okay, so we're gonna start. So we're gonna basically project these with either doing two projections with gamma or two projections with n or the mixed one. But before we do that, let's start by just doing the space-time decomposition of the stress energy tensor and basically introduce some terminology there. So if I project with two copies of n, that's what's usually called the energy density. Because that makes sense because if you want to think of these as fiducial observers, this is the energy density that they would see. We do one spatial and one time projection. Then we get the momentum density. And then the remaining sort of spatial components. It's sometimes called the matter stress tensor. And can also note that if we take the trace of the stress energy tensor T, then we can rewrite that as S minus E in terms of the trace of this and that term. So just to consider an example, we can write down the stress energy tensor for a fluid. Which is energy density plus pressure times the four velocity associated with the fluid, U. And so this is the energy density in the fluid frame. If we do this projection here, we get this, where here you can think of W as kind of a Lorentz factor, Basically, it's how fast this observer that's at rest with the time slices sees this fluid for velocity. So it's energy density, momentum density, and so here these are capital U's, which is sometimes called the Eulerian velocity. And again, that's basically the projection of this four velocity onto our time slice. So you can see this, you know, in addition to this kind of usual like the energy density and the rest frame of the fluid, when the fluid is moving with respect to our fiducial observers, you know, get basically these extra, you know, enhancement due to this with the non-zero Lorentz factor. Okay. All right, so we now sort of have all the pieces we need to project the Einstein equations. So first of all, let's take the Einstein equations and project them with,
question. I think the indices match with the momentum density expression on the left-hand side.
Sorry, which momentum?
Second equation for momentum density.
Yes, you're right. Thank you. Anything else? Good. Okay, so we take the Einstein equations, we hit them with two copies of N. We get this. On the right-hand side, we just get this energy density E. And then if we use, assuming we didn't erase it, equation star right up there, we can rewrite this term. Anybody know the name of this equation? Yeah, so this is known as the Hamiltonian constraint. You'll notice that it basically just involves, you know, the basically things defined in terms of the spatial curvature and the extrinsic curvature, but it doesn't involve any derivatives of the extrinsic curvature. So it's just things on your time slice, not that how they evolve outside your time slice. And you also notice it doesn't make any reference to the lapse and shift. So that's kind of justifies the name constraint. That's basically, it doesn't tell you how things evolve. It's an equation they have to satisfy on your time slice. You know, it does involve second spatial derivatives of the metric, but not second time derivatives. And this is the equation that kind of most closely resembles the like Poisson equation you get in Newtonian gravity. It's also the one that would give you sort of the first Friedmann equation if we're doing cosmology. Okay, so now we're going to take our Einstein equations and now hit it with one n and one gamma. Okay, and what's this term?
Zero,
yes. Because this is orthogonal to the slices of constant time. So now if we use our smiley face equation, we can rewrite this in terms of our 3 + 1 quantities. And so that was the Hamiltonian constraint. And this one is called the momentum constraint for obvious reasons. And again, you'll see that it just involves quantities defined on the time slice and how they and the derivatives on the time slice. And so, and again, it doesn't involve the lapse in the shift. So again, it's a constraint equation. Yeah, so in a couple lectures, we'll actually talk about how one goes about solving these Hamiltonian and momentum constraints in order to sort of start with initial conditions that sort of that satisfy the Einstein equations. But before we do that, we want to basically look at the kind of spatial components of the Einstein tensor by contracting with two copies of gamma. And so to do that, we're going to just rewrite Einstein equations in the trace reverse form. And then apply two gammas. And then we're going to need diamond and triangle equations over there. And applying those, we get the following. And this is just the same as the previous slide. So this is basically the main evolution equation, right? This tells us how to evolve the extrinsic curvature in time. You know, given these quantities, we can compute at some given time. And you know, we already know sort of how to evolve the spatial metric itself, right? We had this expression from last time, but you know, this doesn't really have any physics in it, right? It's basically just a kind of, in some sense, true by definition, or you know, it's just a kinematic equation. Basically, in some sense, comes from how you define the extrinsic curvature. But the physics is really contained in how the extrinsic curvature evolves in time. And you'll notice, of course, that these, in contrast to the constraints, do involve the lapse and the shift, right? So the, you know, you can see the lapse, and then the shift is implicitly in this M. So basically, if we supplement these equations with some prescription for how the lapse and the shift evolve, and choose a good one, not like the Gaussian normal coordinates, and then this can tell us how to start with some initial conditions and evolve forward in time. But you might be sort of worried that we're kind of overdetermined, right? Because you know, we have these constraint equations that should be satisfied at every time, but these evolution equations basically already tell us, you know, if we have k and gamma at some time, they tell us how to get it at a subsequent time. So how can we be sure that if we follow these evolution equations, that these constraint equations will be satisfied at some sort of for all time? So I'm gonna we'll see kind of this evolution of the constraints in some more detail when we talk about a different way of formulating the Einstein equations, the harmonic formulation. But just to kind of roughly sketch the reason for this, it actually follows from the contracted Bianchi identity. So if we write down the Einstein equations, I'm going to call them EAB. There's the Einstein tensor, then minus the matter contribution. Roughly speaking, the constraint equations are just the Hamiltonian constraint is, roughly speaking, just the TT component of this, and the momentum constraint is the TI. So if we take the divergence of this, then you know, we get zero here by the Bianchi identity, and then zero here by stress energy conservation, right? So this means, kind of roughly speaking, we can think of this evolution for the time, and then some index, basically these constraint equations, as we can rewrite them as basically some terms that, you know, involve EAB and then some spatial derivatives of EAB, but that basically vanish when these constraints are satisfied. So is that another way? If we just use the spatial components of the Einstein equations to evolve forward, and we guarantee that on the initial time slice the Hamiltonian momentum constraints are satisfied, then basically this sort of evolution equation for the constraints means that they'll continue to be satisfied at some later time. So that's basically just a sketch, but we'll work that in more detail for the harmonic coordinates in a couple lectures. But before I go, I just want to sort of note one final thing, which is that this is kind of analogous to Maxwell's equations, right? So when we write down Maxwell's equations, we can basically think of two of them as being constraints, that the divergence of E equals the charge density, and are no monopole constraints. And then we have two evolution equations that tell us how our electric and magnetic fields evolve with time. So constraints, evolution equations. And then again, if we can take we can look at the evolution of the constraints just by taking a time derivative. And basically we get that this equals zero, just because the divergence of a kernel is zero. And here we're going to get the divergence of the current. So if we assume charge conservation, then we get zero for this as well. So just like in Maxwell's equations, if we satisfy the constraints initially, the evolution will carry the constraints through. Though also just like in Maxwell's equations, we need our matter to sort of be well behaved. Just like these sources have to be well behaved. You need your stress energy to be conserved as you evolve things forward. Otherwise, you will develop constraint violation. Yeah, so I think that's a good place to end here. Any questions? OK, well, if you have any questions, feel free to come up. And see you tomorrow.